Welcome everyone. It's lovely to see so many people here for tonight's event. In case you don't know us, we're the Forum for European Philosophy. We've been putting on events such as this for the last 20 years. They're all open to the public, they're free, and the reason that they're free is because we have some very generous donors and we get the support of the LSE, and we're very, very grateful for that. If you would like to be one of our donors, feel free to go to our website and follow the links to our Just Giving page. Everything you can give is very, very welcome indeed. And if you go to our webpage, you'll also find our blog and a big archive of podcasts of events just like this that you can also enjoy. Just a few housekeeping matters. If you could turn off the volume on your phone, that would be much appreciated. There's no need to turn off your phone completely. In fact, please feel free to tweet along. We have our very own boutique hashtag, LSEFEP. So please do tweet along with me there. And there's also going to be a podcast at this event, so there'll be a roving mic during the Q&A sections of the event. If you could wait for the microphone to find you so that your voice is recorded for the event, for the podcast, that would be fantastic. And that's enough for me. I'll hand you over to Eleanor for tonight's event.
Okay, hi. My name's Eleanor Knox. I'm a philosopher of science and physics at King's, just down the road, and I'm going to be trying to impose some order on our unruly crew of speakers today. So just to kind of introduce the topic, look, I mean, you might think that we live in an era where science has never been more ever-present and more successful. And it might look as if, I'm putting heavy hedges on this because not all my speakers will agree, but it might look as if science has had considerable success in encroaching on domains of other realms of inquiry. So answering questions that you might have thought were the realm of religion or the realm of philosophy, questions about the origins of the universe, about the origins of human life, for example. And that's led at least some scientists to make extremely grandiose claims about the domain of science. I mean, you may have heard about recent spats. Both Stephen Hawking and Lawrence Krauss have made rather arrogant declarations that philosophy is dead in various ways, often whilst doing bad philosophy. and one might think there's a real debate to be had here. We need to kind of defend our territory. There's a clash between this idea that science is going to take over and have all of the answers, or the idea that we might carve out some domain that remains for other sciences. So that's the question we're going to be asking today is does science have all the answers? And I think there's two ways one might want to divide up that question. One is, does science have something to say about all questions? Someone might answer yes or no to that. And the other is, can science alone answer all questions, which is a rather different question. So even if you thought science had something to say about most things, you might think that other methods of inquiry were also worthy. But I think you'll find a large spectrum of opinions in the panel. So let me just introduce them. Starting from the end, we have Professor James Ladyman, who is at Bristol University, does a wide variety of philosophy, philosophy of science amongst it. And I'm going to give you one title of something each of our panel has done, which will give you some idea of the positions they'll take. So James has, amongst many papers and many books, written a paper called In Defense of Scientism. So that will give you a little hint as tonight's proceedings. Then we have Professor Jen Hornsby, who's at Birkbeck. Jen's a philosopher of mind, action, and feminist philosophy. Her one title that I'm going to mention is Essays in Defense of Naive Naturalism. And then finally, we have Rupert Reed, who's a reader at the University of East Anglia, a Wittgenstein scholar in philosophy of science, and he has written a book called There Is No Such Thing as Social Science. So you'll see that tonight's debate will be lively. So let's try and impose some order on proceedings. So we're going to divide up into three questions, and after a short discussion from the panel, there'll be time for the audience to ask questions about that question. And I'd ask that you sort of try and think about where your burning questions fit in so that this isn't a completely unstructured debate. So one of the questions is going to be about scientism. What do we mean by scientism? Is it an imperialist force or a method of liberation? Another question is going to be, are there any questions that are in principle resistant to scientific inquiry? And the third question is going to be, what is the relationship between philosophical and scientific inquiry? So there'll be an opportunity to discuss each of those things. As I say, let's sort of try and roughly keep things in order. But I think I'm going to ask James to start us off with our first question, which is, what do we mean by scientism? Is it an imperialist force or a method of liberation.
Thank you. Well, when the term scientism was coined originally, it was used to describe people who had the temerity to think that we could find out about human beings and society using scientific methods. And so I think clearly scientism in that sense is correct. We can find out about human beings and society using scientific methods, and we have done. We've found out quite a lot. And the things that we found out have transformed our understanding of our own nature. And they're fundamental to the understanding of most of us of what our nature is. That is, we understand human reproduction, which would otherwise be completely opaque to us. And we understand all sorts of things about ourselves that we otherwise wouldn't understand at all, such as that there's conditions like dementia and autism, and dyslexia, and that, lots more that could be said about generalizations about human behavior and so on. So I think that science clearly can give us answers about human beings and society, and that the track record of people setting in principle limits to what science can tell us about is very bad. However, of course, current science doesn't have all the answers. It doesn't even have all the answers about matter. So of course it doesn't have all the answers about human beings or life. And moreover, I think it's important to stress, when you're defending the kind of position I have, that science is the worst way of acquiring knowledge about the world apart from all the other ones. That is to say, science is fallible, it's often contaminated by culture, by psychology, by sociology, by prejudice, and so on. I am certainly not defending the view that it's infallible or perfect, but I do think, in principle, scientific methods can answer pretty much, well, at least can bear on questions about pretty much anything, including normative questions. So, for example, I think when we understand better our biological nature, it completely changes questions about the rightness or wrongness of killing. For example, in the case of someone who's effectively got no brain left because of dementia. Now, you may not think it settles those questions, but most people on both sides of the debate seems to think that scientific knowledge is relevant to them.
Thank you. Who'd like to follow up?
Yeah, the question was, what do we mean by scientism? And there's a problem about this, because I think the terminology is used perhaps differently by people who have different views. So James is saying roughly, hooray for science. And I quite agree with him that science has cast light on loads of questions about human beings, and we're better off knowing the answers, and arguably even it leads us in better directions ethically and politically to know the answer to these questions. But there's a use of the word scientism which has a history, and it's this use that I've made of the word, where it's used pejoratively of one's opponents. So the thought then is that there's, as it were, a scientistic mindset, and people who have this mindset are inclined to think that questions which actually can't be answered by science are bound to be. And I think one finds that writ large in a lot of contemporary philosophy of mind. So I'm an opponent of much contemporary philosophy of mind. So I think I must mean something different by scientism, but it's partly a terminological thing, that I wouldn't use the word unless I wanted to criticise someone, as it were, whereas James would be saying hooray for a person if he were to use that word of them. And as for whether scientism's an imperialist force or a method of liberation, of course, if you use it in my way, so that you're not inclined to favour the views of the scientistic, then I suppose you will think it's an imperialist force, and all the worse for that. And as for its being a method of liberation, well, it could hardly be a method of liberation if it had the effect of making sure people got questions in philosophy wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Can everyone hear me all right? Yeah. So, what a fascinating topic. There's so, so much to say in so little time. So let me plunge in. So I'm with James in being pro-science. I think science is absolutely great. I mean, more specifically, I think science is a unique method, or rather set of methods that, when they're able to be used, enable us to penetrate and achieve a kind of knowledge that before the advent of science we had just absolutely no parallel for. I think that's absolutely marvellous. But like Jen, I am inclined to use the word scientism in a somewhat different way. My belief is that we live in a culture which is saturated by scientism in the negative sense of the term. I think that scientism is hegemonic in our culture. It's so hegemonic that we can't even see it most of the time. And that makes my task here quite difficult, if I'm right, because I think what I'm saying in a way is that I think that we are all, without even realising it, in the pejorative sense of the word, inclined to be scientistic, just in the way, for example, that the ideology of economic growthism is hegemonic in our society. It's just assumed by virtually everybody, virtually all the time, that of course economic growth is desirable. And of course, you can sum it up in a number, GDP, and of course it should be the number one policy objective of all governments. And by the way, why do I mention that example? Because it's an example of scientism in action, a crucial example of the fallacy of misplaced concreteness, among other things. And to give another example of how I see scientism as being hegemonic, we're increasingly told, or in fact we're not even told, it's just assumed, that whatever we do, we ought to be evidence-based. And I would be the first to acknowledge that evidence-based medicine has achieved some good things. We could discuss where it hasn't achieved such good things. But when we try to extend the idea of being evidence-based to everything, and that's what's starting to happen now, and especially I'm very disturbed by the way people are talking about evidence-based politics. This is pure rhetoric, and it's the rhetoric of scientism. The question one needs to ask whenever anyone says we should be evidence-based is evidence-based as opposed to what? Right? So if you're being evidence-based as opposed to, for example, basing your faith in pure metaphysical speculations or superstitions, well, that's probably a good thing. But if you're being evidence-based as opposed to being ethical, or as opposed to being reflective, or as opposed to being, in some cases, theoretical, or as opposed to being precautious, which is a case I care about particularly strongly, it's very interesting to note the way that a lot of corporations now are using the rhetoric of being evidence-based and saying, if you're opposed to geoengineering, or if you're opposed to genetic engineering, then you're opposed to being evidence-based. Right? That's scientism in action, and it's so widespread and so deep in our culture that, as I say, I think we can hardly see it. So I'm pro-science, but I'm not pro-pseudoscience, and I'm not pro the reckless extinction of science into domains where it doesn't belong. James says, well, we all agree now, don't we, that human beings can be successfully studied by means of scientific methods. Well, yes and no. I mean, we all agree that in the sense that, for example, yes, of course, if we're thinking of human beings as biological organisms, of course they can be studied by means of scientific methods. But have we actually learned anything about the human mind or about society by scientific methods? That's the radical question I want to pose, and that's why, for example, I wrote a book called There Is No Such Thing as a Social Science. I think that most so-called social science and most so-called human science is philosophy in disguise, or politics in disguise, or maths in disguise. It's something genuine in some cases, but science, it ain't.
Either of you?
Rupert and I are somewhat on the same side. I find I want to ask him the question about evidence base. I take it there are questions such that one thinks that evidence has a bearing on them.
Absolutely.
And that it's right to answer those questions on the basis of evidence. I mean,
if they're questions that need answering, yeah, sure.
Well, as you spoke, I thought, I myself think that many politicians often lie. And that if you were to see what was in the background, as it were, what premises they were adducing when they said that it was a good idea to do such and such, you'd see that there was no evidence for what they said. I mean, that's why I think of them as liars. It's not that they outright told the truth. So you're making it seem as though we'd have a sort of rosier society if we gave up on evidence-based.
No. What I was trying to do was suggest that the problem is the supposed obviousness of the appeal to being evidence-based in everything. That, I take it, is a symptom of scientism. I think there's certainly a role for evidence-based politics. For example, I think we should have more evidence-based politics in relation to things where there is a good evidence base and there aren't many other considerations which are more important than evidence. So, one example would be the badger cull. I think the badger cull we ought to have an evidence-based approach to. Mm-hmm. I think this government has been somewhat evidence-based in its approach to the badger cull, but only somewhat. I think it could have been a lot more evidence-based. But as I say, there's a load of issues where the appeal to the rhetorical appeal to being evidence-based, which is pure scientism, is dangerous and misleading. So, for example, I think it's dangerous and misleading where considerations of precaution are more significant. So, for example, the evidence against genetically modified food is, I think, fairly weak. I think the evidence for genetically modified food is also fairly weak. Where I think there's a strong case is there's a strong case on the basis of the precautionary principle against reckless moving into genetically modified food. Now, you can't make that argument if you are told that you have to be evidence-based and nothing else in everything.
Well, you can. You can just say we're evidence-based in the light of how we change what we think we should do, where we take the precautionary principle as what, you know, defines the background view. And so, I mean, look, obviously you can define forms of scientism that are terrible. I mean, here's a strong form of scientism. Alexander Rosenberg published a well-known book in which he argues that there's nothing of any cognitive value in the whole of the arts and humanities. Right? And that's a scientistic view with which I don't agree. So if we're here to use the term and then set up kind of straw positions, well, it's going to be unhelpful because we're just going to get a proliferation of different versions of scientism. I suppose I'd rather concentrate on the substantive issue, which isn't really addressed by kind of rhetoric that's associating applying science to understand society and human beings with thinking that we should have economic growth no matter what, which is really a very specific claim that in no way is, you know, I have to commit myself to just because I think that science can in principle answer, pretty much, not answer. So there are no questions that science in principle can't bear upon. So, I think a lot of what was said there was, you know, one wouldn't disagree, you know, pseudoscience, corporations pretending that they're being scientific. I mean, and Rupert's right that, of course, the power of science is great in society, and so cosmetic companies pretend that they're overpriced, useless products actually have some scientific basis to them, you know. That's pseudoscience.
Yeah, but
and
I think
you can argue that pseudoscience wouldn't be successful if science wasn't influential. So fine. But don't let's define a sensible view that one of us here is going to defend as the view that something like the imitating of science by governments and corporations is a good thing.
But I don't think it's just imitation. I mean, I'm going to do something very unusual now. I'm going to say something very briefly in defense of corporations, including the kind of corporations that like to do genetic engineering, geoengineering, what have you. I think that their claim is correct in the sense that if they say, look, you have to be evidence-based. The evidence-based case against GM is weak. There's no very good evidence that GM crops are harmful and damaging to human beings, etc. The evidence against geoengineering, it's non-existent. You know, we haven't done any yet. So, you know, how can you say that it's going to be harmful? You might say, well, that's a farcical argument. But I would say, insofar as it goes, that's a perfectly good scientific argument. What I want to claim is that precautionary considerations and ethical considerations are supra-scientific, and that they are other considerations that we should bring to bear on claims that are made on the basis of evidence, and those claims may be perfectly good ones, not pseudo-scientific ones.
So there seem to be a couple of things going on here. One is that there are two definitions of scientism, and we do want to make sure that we're sort of talking about one thing. But there are also some claims that Rupert's made that are quite specific that I suspect you might disagree with. So one thing that he said was that on the track record of science, we haven't learned anything about the human mind. And I just wondered, and that's quite a strong claim, and it doesn't depend on your definition of scientism. And I wondered perhaps I'm a gender philosopher of mind, what you think about that question.
Gosh.
By the way, I didn't quite say that. I just asked the question.
Yeah. Have we? Okay, a rhetorical question. Well, that might have had implications.
I'm not sure what's meant by the human mind, because I take it there are cultural differences between members of the species, human being, between one and another time. So one can't make any old generalizations with respect to the human mind. But I suppose I do think that there's something distinctive about human beings which makes them different from other objects on the planet Earth. And that there are questions about what's distinctive of them, which tell us what it is, as it were, to operate cognitively and practically as a human being. And that in answering those questions, we don't actually need science.
Well, I definitely disagree about that. And I think that science has told us loads about the human mind. For example, the importance of subconscious and non-conscious thought in determining our decisions, and the existence of things like blind sight, the two visual systems, the very important links between motor function and perception, the fact that taste is actually smell, which you would never arrive at by a priori reflection, and much more besides. I mean, I already mentioned lots of atypical psychology that we now understand, which we previously would have regarded as just aberration or insanity, or just have some some very crude way of conceptualizing. And now we can clearly say, no, this child isn't a horrible child. They're distressed because they're autistic and they're having trouble engaging in normal forms of learning, and if we give them a different way of learning, that's going to make their lives and their parents' lives easier. And I take it that anybody who's got experience of examples like dementia or autism or dyslexia will be extremely grateful for the scientific understanding that we now have of our psychology. And I think, you know, many, many other examples of post-traumatic stress disorder, the role of hormones in determining our mood, even understanding what happens in romantic love. Now, that's not to say that those scientific studies answer all questions, and I certainly don't think that science can replace values and making decisions based on what we think is ethical. I just think that there's in pretty much every domain, deciding what's ethical is better done when you're scientifically well informed about what the relevant science is, which is not going to be a complete answer, but it is going to be relevant, and it is going to affect your ethical deliberations.
Can I just say something quickly about, because I qualified when I was asked a question about the human mind. I mean, James's answer, I take it, assumes that the human mind is that which psychologists study, and some of them do experiments and collect data and tell us more. But I think insofar as there's a tradition in philosophy for asking questions about the human mind, some of which come under the head of the so-called mind-body problem, those questions aren't the ones which psychologists purport to give us the answers to. They asked them long before there was any such subject as psychology, for one thing.
So on the thing about we should be scientifically informed in whatever we do, I think we're all in agreement on that. The disagreement is going to be how much information we have and what the nature of that information is. James reeled off a load of interesting examples. It would take ages to discuss them all. But let me just say something about a couple of them. So post-traumatic stress disorder, I think you have to be very, very careful around post-traumatic stress disorder. It's pretty clear, it seems to me, now that post-traumatic stress disorder, so-called, has very significant cultural and indeed historical and political dimensions, and that some of the work, to say some, of the work around so-called PTSD has overrode that and has done so scientifically. Autism, I'm not sure exactly what James has in mind on autism, but in recent years, certainly insofar as philosophers have been interested in autism, they've been very interested in so-called theory of mind theory and simulation theory as accounts of what autism is. I consider both of those theories to be disastrous failures that abstract from the sense in which when human beings are able to socialize and learn and so on normally, What they do is something which is natural to them. And the fundamental problem with both those theories is they make it seem, basically, as if what we do when we normals, you know, probably not everybody in the room, but are engaged in social interaction, etc., with each other, is a sort of easier and more natural version of the same thing that autists do. And that's where I think the fundamental mistake is. A lot of what autists do, it seems to me, is actually make up for the fact that they're not able to engage in that natural alignment and attunement with other human beings by doing things which actually are remarkably like some of the things described, especially in theory of mind theory. So I think philosophy can enable us to understand the right kind of philosophy. Broadly hermeneutic philosophy, Wittgensteinian philosophy, can enable us to understand something about how normals interact and understand and negotiate the social world, etc. The tragedy of autists is that they tend to lack that, and as a result have to compensate for it. So but it seems to me that both theory of mind theory and simulation theory fundamentally misunderstand that and get that the wrong way around.
Yeah, those philosophical theories notwithstanding, I think you should be really... Well, I think you should be more circumspect in your use of the word normal. Autistic people are perfectly normal, they're just not typical. There's nothing massively unusual about autism, dyslexia, extreme forms of psychopathology are normal in the sense that a normal population, average population, the population, includes quite a lot of people like that. So let's not confuse atypical or not like the mean and abnormal or unnatural, which I think you use that several times. You start talking about what's natural and so on. There's nothing unnatural about an autistic person.
I'm a little concerned that we need to move to Q&A and that this debate in particular is going to take a turn slightly away from our topic. So I might just leave it with that comment of James's. So I want to move to audience questions. How we're going to do this is there'll be a roving mic and you need to wait for it to arrive at you. And because this is being podcast, I'll take a couple of questions at a time and then we'll put them to the panel. Can we focus on the kinds of things that we were just talking about? So the role of science and scientism as a sort of force for good or evil, and perhaps this question about this sense in which the mind comes under the domain of science, which has cropped up as well. All right, questions? Yes, the first one I saw was at the front there in the middle. Keep your hands up, and there's another one down here at the front.
No, yes, well, very interesting. Talking about scientism, nobody has mentioned the word technology, and I'd be interested in what you see as, if you like, the the philosophical difference between, I suppose, on the one hand, understanding the causes of things, and on the other hand, having an objective that you want to achieve, like sailing across the Atlantic, and how it's going to be best to do it. And of course, very different from that is why you want to do things like sail across the Atlantic in the first place.
Okay, thanks. And can I just take one more question before we have the audience? Go ahead.
Okay, so I'm quite interested in how does one develop one's intuition and how that intuition gets informed by, you know, a solid experimental and verifiable concrete facts to some extent, and how you embed that within some sort of model that gets constructed.
Okay, great, thank you. So those are both great questions. So I take it the first one was about the role of technology, and I suppose the perhaps contrast between science viewed as a kind of pragmatic enterprise that helps us achieve our ends, perhaps defined outside science, and science deemed as a kind of foundational knowledge gathering exercise. So does anyone have any...
I have a comment, which is that there's often an association between thinking that you need technology to solve problems and respect for science, but that correlation isn't a necessary one at all. So, for example, I might think that the best way to solve the problem of malaria is to provide sanitation and clean water and to eliminate open sewers from where people are living, and that it doesn't follow at all that just because I think that science tells us about things in the sense of this question, that I then think that the solution to problems is a technological one as opposed to a social or political or economic one. So I just want to make that clear, because lots of people who are sort of scientistic are then also people who want to reach for an expensive technological solution to problems that might seem to quite obviously have more just economic, social and political solutions.
Yeah, so good again to see some common ground there. I think that what James has just said is absolutely right. Of course, as he acknowledged, it is quite a common phenomenon for scientifically minded people to sort of make that extension and to think that technology or engineering falls under the umbrella of science or somehow inherits all of its kind of legitimacy or kudos or something. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's fundamentally up to society to decide which technologies it wants to apply and when and why. It's up to society to decide how much science it's going to fund, to some extent, which kinds of science it's going to fund. But society doesn't get to decide what scientific knowledge is. But science generates knowledge in a sense in which technology and engineering don't. And it's also a fallacy to think that an awful lot of technology and engineering is derived from or dependent upon so-called pure science. An awful lot of it isn't. An awful lot of successful technology, for example, comes from people tinkering or from people engaged in various kinds of commercial enterprises which have only a very remote relationship, if any, to science, certainly to the scientific research frontier. So I think we should actually detach technology and engineering from science a great deal more than we're accustomed to in this scientific and technocratic society.
Okay, and can we move on to the question about the role of intuition and the way in which our intuitions are informed by perhaps empirical research? So is this sort of an independent faculty, or is this something that that one develops by science? Perhaps Jen, you might have.
I may not be clear what the question is. I take it when we say that our intuition is that, we take ourselves to be relying on common sense, not to be stating some fact of science. I think it's very interesting the extent to which intuitions about what might seem to be common sense have changed over history. That's to say, science gradually has had an impact on what people are apt to say instinctively and by intuition. I could give some examples, but I'm not sure whether I'm responding to the question before I say any more.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true, and I think that was implicit in what the speaker was saying. I mean, I thought it was an interesting question because as you point out, we shouldn't think this way, but we so often think that intuition is just somehow what's there independently of everything else. And in fact, intuition is often culturally received, and to some extent science feeds into that. So the challenge for anyone who's a scientist is to get good intuitions, right, about what they're studying, and they get that, as you suggest, by learning as much as they can about what's known, so that their guesses and hunches about what's unknown are more reliable than they would be if they relied upon intuition that hadn't been schooled.
Of course, my first take on intuition was via the notion of common sense. And if there is such a thing, I think it can be contrasted with science. I mean, this is part of the disagreement between James and me, I take it.
But often
I don't want to be scientistic in his sense, partly because I think there's a whole lot that I know and perhaps intuitively think, which I don't rely on science to. Though I do rely on the world's having history and human beings knowing stuff and my speaking a language with people who also know that stuff, so that my common sense, as it were, has been informed scientifically. But it's not science.
Well, I agree about that.
Okay, wonderful. I'm going to move on. I think we're running a little short on time for this question, so there was one question at the front, I think, that I missed. So I'll just take that one and then we'll move on to the next topic. Could you grab the mic? Thank you.
Hello there. You mentioned genetically modified organisms, and you're not clear about the claims that are being made against them, it seemed.
What I said was I think the evidence against GM food is fairly weak, but that doesn't mean the case against GM is weak, because there are other considerations, right, namely precautionary and ethical considerations.
Right. So for example, the organism that is used, we'll say, right, they found out these organisms and they interfere with nature and they produce this stuff and they call it food. And they used glyphosate. That's a marketing device to sell glyphosate, essentially. And glyphosate is now turning up in people's systems. And poison, it's recently been declared by the EPA of California as a carcinogen, of which obviously Monsanto is resisting like crazy. But that's what's going on. How would you see that in terms of science?
Yes, a very specific question, just to give a brief... we could have a whole evening on just that, but which is fascinating and important. Let's put it this way. I'm no keener on glyphosate than you are, but I don't think the case is proven that glyphosate is causing or has caused or will cause an epidemic of cancer. But my case is you shouldn't have to prove that in order to have concern about those crops. I think the concern is very valid, even without that proof. And all these questions of risk analysis, negotiating these difficult areas of uncertainty, ignorance, and so on and so forth, they're questions which, of course, science is relevant to, but science cannot settle them. And it's a grave danger of the rhetoric of scientism, which is so all-consuming in our society, that we incline to think, well, what could settle that except science? No, these questions have to be settled by philosophical reasoning, by precautionary thinking, by ethical thinking, by democratic deliberation, and that's something which is not exhausted at all by science.
Okay, that actually moves us very nicely onto our next question, which Jen's going to start on, which is, are there any questions that are in principle resistant to scientific inquiry?
Yes, I think the answer to that question is yes, and I'm going to start with maybe a billion examples. You'll think I'm cheating, but I can elaborate further. I think if you were to walk out onto Kingsway and were to ask any random stranger, where are you going, they'd know the answer. I'm inclined to think that human beings in general, if they're walking somewhere, are doing so because they want to get there. There's a reason, and they know where they're walking. And just multiply, that was just one, but I take it that all over this planet there are people walking places or going places by whatever mode, and who know, so it's a fact, that they're going to such and such place. So I think it's sort of obvious that there are questions that are in principle resistant to scientific inquiry. If you want to know where someone's going, she's the best person to ask. That's what you need to find out, something that she knows, and it isn't a matter of science by virtue of which she knows it. Now, of course, you might think, well, any questions in principle to resistant to scientific inquiry, we're not concerned with questions about where people are going. We're concerned with the kind of generalizations that people who work in universities may be concerned with for one or another reason. But actually, it seems to me that the fact that people are apt to know where they're going, or to know more generally what they're doing when they're doing something, does raise a question of a philosophical sort, which is, what is it to be doing something for a reason, where I take it most of the time people have some reason they might be able to give you for what they're doing. And that question, I think, what is it to do something for a reason, which is a question in the philosophy of action, which is something I do, I think isn't a question that scientists broach or would know how to broach.
James, can you be very quick? Because I expect you'll disagree more strongly. So I might let you go first.
I often don't know what I'm doing or where I'm doing. and I think you have a much more optimistic view of the rational integrity of most agents. I think, of course, if it's something trivial like where are you going when you're walking down the street, but ask people, really, what's your motivation for how you behaved in that situation? I think we all know that people often aren't very good at answering that question about themselves, and that people around them can be better at answering it than than the individuals themselves. Now, you may well say, well, that's still not science. But I think the idea that something like purposive human behaviour is not illuminated by scientific inquiry, that sounds to me like a false claim.
I didn't say that, exactly.
Okay. That's all right,
you were talking about deep-seated motivations. They weren't on the scene. I mean, that was why my question was trivial, as you see it.
Okay. Well,
it might matter to someone terribly, actually, where another person was going.
Okay, I'm happy to concede that we don't need science to know where we're going most of the time when we're just walking somewhere. But I mean, surely the reason what we're here is because people have in mind questions like, what really is a human being, and what is life, and what is death, and what's the difference between someone, you know, who has the cognition of a human being and the cognition of a higher primate, or the cognition of a whale, or the cognition of a dolphin, or whatever. And I mean, all those kinds of questions, we do need science to answer.
You're just setting aside questions that I was trying to draw to attention. I mean, here's a reason why we're here. We all knew that this forum was happening here. We all wanted somewhat to go to the forum. And we all knew how to get here. That's why we're all here.
Rupert.
So I'm with Jen, I think, in this little dispute, if it is a dispute. But I want to go further, because I disagree with the claim that James made at the end there about, oh, you know, if you want to know what life is and death is and primates and dolphins, and that's all science. I don't think so. It seems to me, for example, that in relation to primatology and cetology, some of the greatest progress has been made by those primatologists, especially, notably, and I think not coincidentally, nearly all women, who realised that applying the methods of science was pretty much useless in gaining any understanding of these creatures. And what you actually had to do was, a set of interesting things. One thing you have to do is you have to understand among primates, for example, that they have interactions and institutions, if you will, that are well described or well understood as political. And, of course, I don't think that politics is a social science. I think it's essentially something that we understand, if you will, from the inside as a kind of an art. Another thing that you have to do, and this famously was understood by, what's her name, the Gorillas in the Mist woman, is you have to try to, if you will, enter into the mindset of the primates. And that means actually doing things like interacting with them. Not just kind of observing and, you know, noting down correlations and assembling huge reams of data, forming theories about mental states and so on and so forth. You have to actually be there, and if you want to really understand what they're like. One of the reasons I think that cetology is still in a fairly infant state is it's just really hard to do this kind of thing with dolphins and whales, which are so massive and live in the water, which we're not very good at getting around, and have these, you know, unbelievably rich and complicated moral lives we're now finding out, and cultural lives. The way to understand these beings is as beings, not as objects of scientific experiments. The way to understand them is as beings. Now, on the question we've been asked to address here, the question of kind of, you know, can science answer all the questions and that kind of thing? I want to pose something more radical, if you will, than what Jen said even, which is I think that even the notion that answers is what we should be after here may be prejudicial. I think that itself may contain a scientific prejudice. What do I mean by that? Well, some questions might be better not answered. I think we all know what I mean, actually, instantly when I say that, right? There are some kinds of questions where if you try to pursue those questions, you will kill the phenomenon that you're interested in. Other questions would be better not asked at all. How do we find out which those questions are? We cannot find that out by doing science. The only way we can find it out is by thinking philosophically, ethically, and so on. And sometimes even having a question is prejudicial. Sometimes what one is doing is simply sort of fumbling about, trying to come up with a question or trying to come up with something which isn't even a question. Scientists have research questions. Sometimes it seems to me that what philosophy is thinking that needs to exist before there are even things as well formed as questions. If you were to ask, for example, what was Heidegger's research question? Or what was Wittgenstein's research question? These are the questions we're told to ask and answer nowadays in the academic world, by the way. We'll come on to this maybe in a little bit. I think you'd be asking the wrong question. It's even more obvious if you ask the question, what was the Buddha's research question? I mean, it's just not the right way to think about things. And I think that we're still in the grip of scientism if we think it's all about questions and answers.
But one of the things that's cropping up in this debate is a particular view of what science is. That, I mean, I wonder, is sort of being more shared by the people who are sort of defending non-scientific territory than it might be by some scientists. So you both seem to be applying a sort of view of the scientific method, where the scientific method involves asking sort of some particular set of questions, some particular kind of question, and also involves sort of objectifying. This is something that Rupert brought up. So treating, say, primates as objects. I'm meant to be the chair, but I'll put in my two cents here, which is that I had never thought of science as the scientific method as defined by that. I thought it was an extension, actually, of some of the common sense reasoning that Jen's been advocating. And our basic method of inquiry about the world is empirical. Now, some facts are very directly, easily, empirically accessible, like very simple reasons that people, but some things are more complicated, and you need sort of to ask many more questions and gather lots more data before you're in a position to answer them. But I wonder if anyone could say something about the conception of science that's demarcating some questions as non-scientific here.
Well, yes, there's a question of how capaciously we should use the word science itself. And in arguing to the extent that I have against James, I'm happy to use it very capaciously. I still maintain that some questions aren't, as it were, for science. But, of course, someone like Rupert or me who finds a use for a pejorative sense of the term scientism, may be apt to think that there are some questions which, if you like, they have scientific answers when we use the word science capaciously, but which nonetheless tend to be addressed as if it was a physicist who would know the answer to them. And the example of the behaviour of non-human animals that Rupert mentioned, I think, is relevant here. If you look at early 20th century animal behaviour and ethology, you see that the people who did it struggling not to use ordinary vocabulary, as it were. So you've got these sticklebacks and they're swimming and there's a zigzag motion. But then we've got to describe it in terms of a stimulus, as it were. So we've got to use the scientific vocabulary to capture what we see. Now, of course, I think that there can be animal behaviourists and there can be ethologists and that can be a species of scientist. But they're scientistic unless they accept some of what Rupert said about needing to, you know, understand what's going on.
But sometimes your scientism is being used as a word for doing bad science, which slightly moves us off our... I mean, you know, well, doing prejudicial science or doing very biased science.
Well, it's because they have... I take it that the criticism of scientism applies to these people, even if what they're doing is science, because they have a conception of science which is the wrong one, as it were, if you use science in such a way that it's not only physics, it's also biology, it's also the social sciences, though not so according to Rupert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to hazard an answer to what the research questions of the great philosophers were. So, Socrates' question was, how should I live, or what is a good human life? And I suspect that the Buddha's is something very similar, or perhaps a version of it might be, how can people be happy? Heidegger... Well, I'm not sure, but it's something like, what can hammers tell us about being? And Wittgenstein wanted to understand how language worked, didn't he?
No, not really.
Quite a lot of philosophers have been interested in the question, how do human beings gain knowledge?
Yes.
And I take it that you need a conception of that which they get to know, as well as what it is to know. Mm. In order to take on that question.
If you think, as most philosophers have done, that one of the main ways that people gain knowledge is through perception, mm-hmm. then the scientific study of perception is surely relevant to the question, how do people gain knowledge?
Yeah, but I take it Jen's point was there's a fundamental question there, which I take it was part of Heidegger's problematic, right? Which is you have to actually think about knowledge. Another example would be Heidegger's great late work, The Question Concerning Technology. And any of you who've read that difficult book will know that, that Heidegger's exact point is that you cannot simply ask the question, is technology good or is technology bad? Nor even ask the question, what is technology? You ought to say that all of those questions prejudice the issue. And to do the real philosophical thinking that needs to be done here, the kind of questions that people ask around the concept of technology are not going to actually help you to do that. That's the kind of thing I meant by saying I think that asking what their research question is going to get you in on the wrong foot. On the question of data, see, I think, again, the term data is prejudicial. And obviously we can use the term data to talk about anything. We could say, you know, I had various data that helped me to arrive here this evening. I consulted my to Z, I asked a friend, etc. I mean, we could extend the term data till it becomes almost meaningless and encompasses everything. Or we can use the term data as physicists and chemists and biologists and so on actually use it, which is extremely different from that. And the claim that I want to make is that in the sense in which those folks who I think are paradigm examples of scientists, I'm sure we'd all agree, use the term data fundamentally doesn't help us to understand the nature of society. And in that sense, the whole enterprise of social science gets us off on the wrong foot. And I would say, by the way, the same about metaphysics. Some people might have been coming here this evening sort of assuming that I was going to be the sort of soft, sort of fuzzy, sort of romantic one, and that James was going to be the sort of hard-nosed, you know, sort of pro-science, etc. one, and that Jen was going to be somewhere in between the two of us. But I'd like to make the claim that on this question, I'm actually, if you will, the most pro-science of all, because I want to say science is what it is and not everything else. And to me, it's extraordinary that James wants to make the claim that metaphysics is itself, or at least when it's done well, when it's done by people like him and so on, is itself a scientific enterprise. It seems to me it's and here, of course, I follow Wittgenstein, it's the primary example of pseudoscience. So I actually want to restrict the term science to what the term belongs to.
I think I'm going to let James come in because you've just attacked your argument. He hasn't, in fact, made in this form, as far as I can tell, although he has, but it's on record.
Based on what people may have been reading before they got here.
Well, I mean, I mean, somewhat rhetorically saying, I don't think Heidegger's a great example of a kind of pure philosophical method that will lead us to a truth that's uncontaminated. So, I don't know what exactly. I mean, you know, you want to. It seems to me that often, if it's, and this is why I said the thing about, it's, you know, science is the worst kind of knowledge apart from all the rest. I also think, you know, having your philosophical inquiry contaminated by science is better than having it contaminated by superstition and received wisdom and tradition and, you know, whatever conception of the folk you have. You know, in Heidegger's case, a really unpleasant conception of an authentic human existence that was very exclusive. So, yeah, I mean, you know, science is liberation. Well, science liberates us from other kinds of dogma. Scientific dogma can also be wrong, but at least it's in the process of being corrected by the ongoing inquiry of science, and it's come from previous experiment and empirical inquiry rather than just being received unreflectively from tradition.
We're going to have to move on to audience Q&A again. Can I just check, though, in an attempt at a bit of peacemaking, before the Q&A, does everyone agree that the answer to are there any questions that are in principle resistant scientific inquiry is yes?
No.
Oh, I know. Oh, dear. I thought perhaps normative questions.
I thought it was okay as long as they were trivial.
No, I think that normative questions are not answered by science, but I think you'd be hard pushed to say in advance that science, there's any normative questions that science will never bear upon.
Okay.
So I gave the... I mean, no, for,
I think we all agree on that.
That's why I choose a normative question when I write.
But resistant scientific inquiry is a slightly different...
I think the questions about what people's motivations are and what their purposes are when they're going somewhere are also, in principle, open to scientific inquiry.
No, each of them has her reason to go.
Yeah, and in principle... The question about her reason is for where she's going is open to scientific inquiry. Science could, in principle, bear on that question.
Okay.
She may, for example, be labouring under a cognitive illusion. She may, for example, think she's doing something for a reason and that's not the real reason she's doing it.
I think you should be allowed...
I mustn't say more now.
Are you sure? Okay. In that case, questions from the audience. On this question of what questions are resistant to scientific inquiry, there's a question... there, and then there's another one over there if the other remote, if the other microphone can go that way.
Hi. Well, I'm a biologist, so I'm a scientist as a background, and all my life I've been hearing about these two cultures. Why do we keep limiting the space of philosophy or humanities and science? Why don't we think that actually only integrative answers are possible to certain questions?
My question is,
why don't are we asking if there are questions that are not possible to answer with science, but these questions are only possible to answer if we use an integrative approach, so with both humanities and sciences.
All right, thanks. And what's the second question?
Thank you. I'd love each of the speakers to say something a little bit more general, because... this is a conversation about explanation, and more specifically, it's a conversation about reduction, which kinds of explanations might or might not be reducible to which other kinds of explanations. How far do we reduce? Everyone has said a little bit here and there, but where one draws the line and which kind of line, I think we've been left a little bit unclear about. Let me just stick an example onto this question. We make music. That we make music, that human beings make music, may be explainable by science, not physics, but other kinds of science. Question mark. Does science explain why the classical symphony comes into existence? No. Question mark. Does science explain why Beethoven's Diabelli variations are a humorous piece of music? Question mark. Where along this series of examples does one draw the line? Some general comments would be welcome from each of the speakers. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. So the first question, I take it, was that concerned the interplay between science and philosophy, which I only want to comment briefly on because that's our next question. But this idea that perhaps, you know, the very fact that we can have this debate shows that one has to bring both kinds of inquiry to bear. Does anyone have any particular comments?
Well, I have a really quick answer to that. I mean, I didn't see anything I was saying as being in conflict with the idea of using both approaches. What I was saying was that there's no subject matter that you should ignore science in principle in studying. Okay, that doesn't mean that you think that you shouldn't also look at humanities and arts and other kinds of inquiry. I'm just saying that the track record of people saying, oh, we've got this domain here, whether it's human beings, life, consciousness, whatever it is, that science can't tell us anything at all about is bad, and that we shouldn't set limits to what science can bear upon. So integration, fine.
So James used the term subject matter. I mean, you might see me in the discussion that's gone before as... defending philosophy, is that a subject matter maybe against scientism, and Rupert is defending politics or politics against scientism. Of course, subject matters in the course of life don't divide as neatly as that, so I was suggesting that there must be an evidence base to for the answer to lots of political questions, so I couldn't agree wholeheartedly with Rupert. But of course, what these questions, the two questions, remind us of is that there are all sorts of questions which aren't philosophy or politics, and which we think if we ask why questions about them, why should there have evolved the classical symphony, we won't turn to science to answer, although we may find illuminating things to say about them by looking at history and musicology. So this reminds me of James's criticism of Rosenthal. If you remember, he said Rosenberg said that there was no cognitive value attaching to anything except science. But I take it that cognitive value does attach to the humanities, that it can't be sharply separated from the sciences. And I just wonder whether, as soon as one's allowed that the notion of cognitive value goes with the notion of truth, whether one isn't obliged then to think that science can't answer all the questions, because surely there are some truths, questions answered with the truth, which are not scientific truths.
So the question you first ask about the two cultures, you know, why has it been so hard to reconcile the two cultures? There's a certain sense, it seems to me, in which we can give a sort of historical, if you will, answer to that question, which is it's because of scientism. It's because it's really, really hard in our society to get a hearing for, let alone money for, anything which isn't dressed up in the form of science. It's been delegitimated, and that's part of what my concern is. In terms of the fascinating question about music, I mean, in a way, we haven't really had a chance to talk about this, and we've got 25 minutes left. In a way, what I'm trying to say here this evening is that my concern about scientism, it sounds very reasonable when James says, well, all I'm saying is that science could be relevant to...
It sounds
to
reasonable because it is reasonable.
And it is very reasonable, because I agree with it as far as it goes. But my concern is this, that what I want to do is to ensure that what that doesn't become a license for, as it has so often over the past century, for example, especially... is for the elimination of any sense that there is a domain of life, a domain of society, types of understanding, sorts of activities, which we inhabit fundamentally from the inside. And I use a metaphor there, from the inside. The metaphor is, if you will, indispensable. I think that an awful lot of what we have to say about music and numerous other things... is simply not going to be comprehensible from a scientific point of view, because a scientific point of view is a point of view that does not inhabit as a practitioner and as an appreciator, but as someone who essentially seeks to provide a theory, provide an explanation, provide an account, which can be understood in principle, that so the theory goes, by anybody. And that's, if you will, fundamentally what I deny. And in denying that, I'm following people like Peter Winch and Ludwig Wittgenstein.
Okay, great. So there was I thought the question about music was actually a really nice one to sort of triangulate your viewpoints.
Yeah.
So perhaps we could move to that. So the question there was, you know, there's this sort of chain of explanation that you might explain why we create music. Then you might try and explain, you know, sort of the aesthetic properties of some piece of music. And there's a sequence of questions one could ask. And I think... one of the things that the question I want to know is where you each stood on at what point science stopped being involved in those questions. James?
So what I wanted to say, which I thought was a very good question, and perhaps a difficult one for me, unless you kind of expand your vision a bit, is that my point is what we can't rule out in principle, right? I don't think I know enough to rule out that there are other planets in the universe in which people have evolved music, in which beings something like us have evolved music, right? Now, if there were enough such planets, it might be that in a million years' time, future anthropologists had studied enough civilizations to make generalizations about the kind of music they developed. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen. That's a science fiction scenario, right? It makes all sorts of assumptions. I mean, it assumes that maybe, you know, for example, maybe the form of human life is such that it evolves somewhere else in the universe as well. Now, maybe not, but I don't know enough to rule that out. So I can't rule out that a scientific anthropology won't tell us about how different kinds of cultures evolve different kinds of music. And so, in principle, even that question is not... science is not completely irrelevant to it. Even that question science might bear upon. That's not to say that we're going to give a reductive explanation and explain why we have symphonies in terms of quantum mechanics or something. I mean, it could be an explanation that's at the level of anthropology. But it was it's still possible that scientific inquiry could bear upon that question.
I confess I'm not impressed by the idea that in a million years' time, should it so be now or at some other time, that planets evolved so that the anthropocentric perspective was relevant to its inhabitants, then we could answer that question. I mean, that's close to per impossibile.
Why is this question? Look, I mean, the universe is vast, there's loads of planets, there could be intelligent life, but intelligent life...
I think she's questioning that.
I'm questioning whether we could answer the question. But also, I think it's the kind of question on which I can imagine someone making headway. But without resorting to science. And I think that's actually the more important point in connection with this question. There were two parts to it. There was the classical symphony and the...
Humorousness. Beethoven's.
Yeah.
Do you think science can, in principle, never tell us about humour?
Never tell us about humour, never tell us anything about humour. Those are different questions, right? Yeah. There's the never tell us everything about humour and never tell us anything. And sometimes I think we're going
to
get
I've been very careful, because I mean, it's not obvious to me that there's ever the ability to say everything about anything.
No, indeed.
Right? So if scientism is defined as the view that science can one day answer every question and give a complete explanation of something, I might say, no, it can't do that about anything, even matter. Right? So let's not confuse thinking that science can bear upon questions and give it. It may be that for every question science answers, it raises another question. In which case, no matter how much we learn, there'll always be more to learn. In which case, we'll never get an end to explanation. So my view can't be that explanations end or that science gives a full stop. Right? But my view is that even music, human culture, might be illuminated by scientific inquiry.
We're going to have to move on. I promise that those of you who had our hands up, I'll try and make you next on the next Q&A. But let's move on to our final question. And if we can try and be a little bit brief in our answers, because we're going to run out of time. So Rupi's going to start us on. What's the relationship between philosophical and scientific inquiry?
Yeah, so much to say here. I'm going to start out by making one or two perhaps slightly kind of boring sort of quasi-institutional points, drawing on what I already said before. It seems to me that in philosophy in the academic world, we are being more and more positioned to be modelled on science. And there are some philosophers who seem to welcome this development, and there are others, such as myself, who do not. And one of the ways that I don't is I think that it prejudices our discipline to be told that what we have to do has to be entirely constructed around research questions. I think that's already getting us off on the wrong foot. In terms, then, of thinking about science and philosophy, if I were to very, very crudely characterise their natures, I would say that science builds, and it builds by asking and answering questions, and that philosophy questions, but not necessarily by answering or even asking questions. And that's what I was trying to get at before by talking about the way the question concerning technology doesn't answer or even ask the questions that people think there are around technology. I wonder if the fundamental disagreement this evening can be helpfully approached in this way. So James said earlier that the worst way of acquiring knowledge about the world, apart from all the others, is science. And Jen sought to say, well, but there are some things that we know which we don't know by means of science. But my thinking is that actually the most important thing to try to bring into this debate and to show how deeply infected we are by scientism is that there are also alternatives to knowledge, that knowledge isn't all it's cracked up to be, and knowledge isn't everything. So what do I mean by that? So I'll give a few examples. I think that care and love are enormously important, and I don't think that they can be cashed out through thinking about knowledge. I think that our connection to or immersion in the world and with other beings, including non-human animals, our sense of joy in life, I don't think any of these things can be understood to any very significant extent by means of scientific method. I think that pre-care or precaution, as I said earlier, is fundamentally something beyond the remit of science. Wisdom, an old-fashioned word. I'm with Socrates and with London's Nick Maxwell in thinking that wisdom is a deeply worthy and necessary goal. And science can only ever be one component of that goal. Contemplation is something which cannot be fundamentally understood in scientific terms. Science can tell us some things about the brain of people who are contemplating, but contemplation and what contemplation can yield is not something that can be understood by means of science, and the same is true of most of meditation. Action, so as I said earlier, a lot of technological actions can't be understood through the frame of science. If you ask for an evidence base for taking various kinds of actions, you're not going to get anywhere. I'll give another example of that. In politics, someone who asks, do we have enough evidence to be in a position to undertake a revolution in this country, is asking the wrong question. That person is not a revolutionary. And if you think there's ever a time when one ought to be a revolutionary, if you think it was right to be a revolutionary in Tunisia in 2011 or in France in 1789, then you're not thinking in a fundamentally scientific way, and I think that's all to the good. And finally, creation, classic example. I think that most important aspects of the creation of something new by human beings cannot be illuminated by science. When something genuinely new is created by human beings, by definition, it's not something which can be scientized. Shown in the lovely anecdote of when somebody famously asked Louis Armstrong, "Mr. Armstrong, where is jazz going?" Louis Armstrong smiled and replied, "If I knew where jazz was going, I'd be there already." The human future is constitutively unknowable, and that is a principal limitation on the powers of science.
Jen?
Good. I mean, one of the things Rupert said is that knowledge is not the only good, which, of course, I'm happy to agree with. But he started out in an institutional framework. Like him, I find it regrettable that the position of philosophy in universities is conceived of as it is. But I do actually think that that the point of universities is that knowledge should be passed on and acquired, as it were. So if we're focusing on our institutions, then it does seem to me we want to single out knowledge as the good. But perhaps I can say something which resonates with some of the things that Rupert said nonetheless. I take it that not all knowledge is knowledge of facts, that there's such a thing as knowing one's way about a subject matter. Yeah. Sellers made something of this, and he alluded to a discussion of practical knowledge. So I take it that when people start out as students and they're going to learn stuff, it isn't that we want them to go away. And there are all sorts of questions that now they can answer, which previously they couldn't, because there are this, that, and the other fact that they now know. I take it there's such a thing as knowledge which is gained, which is knowledge of how to find their way about a subject matter, how to think about things, if you like.
I'm inclined to think that if philosophers were to justify their existence on the grounds of the wisdom that they've developed, as opposed to the questions they were going to illuminate, they'd be worse off. Because I've known an awful lot of philosophers in my time, and I haven't noticed that they're particularly overdeveloped compared to everybody else in respect of wisdom.
We seek it, we don't necessarily have it.
Right, so what are you going to say is philosophers are important because they think they're wise?
No, because they're trying to be wise. They think it's worth trying.
They're not trying any more to be wise than anybody else.
I don't think they are.
Well,
let's hear James's conception of philosophy. Go on.
I mean, again, right, I mean, even if they are trying, if they're trying more than anybody else, but succeeding no better, that's problematic. So, really, I don't want to defend philosophy in universities by saying, you need to keep us in employment, we're the wise people in society. That's not a good way to go. And I think that, you know, what you say about research questions, I mean, yeah, if you put it in terms of, your research questions can be critical, they can be negative, they can be about problematizing and all the things that we think are important other than, I mean, I'm a great believer in universities as sources of critique, as sources of skepticism, as places where we don't try to we don't just try to find new things out, we also try to understand the limits of what we've already learned, to understand better what it is that we think we've already learned, and so on and so forth. So, you know, I'm not going to defend a kind of an instrumental idea of philosophy or academic inquiry or anything else, but I do think we'd be really wary about suggesting that that philosophers are somehow, you know, developing wisdom in ways that other people aren't.
Can you say something about what you think philosophy is doing?
Well, I gave a couple of examples. I mean, I think what often philosophy does is it comes... Look, let me give you an example, right? This is an example from my colleague Samira Kasher, drew this to my attention, and I hadn't quite thought about it before. In economics, there are notions of rationality. In evolutionary biology, there are notions of rationality. In psychology, there are notions of rationality. There are kindred theories in all those domains. One thing that philosophers can do is come along and say, is your notion of rationality, the economist, the same as the notion of rationality the biologist is using? That kind of conceptual inquiry is valuable, important, clarifying. You know, it may even contribute to wisdom. I think it's more likely to contribute to a wisdom than me just sitting there not knowing anything about what anybody else is doing and trying to become wise by thinking about reason. I think, you know, wisdom that goes in hand with knowledge is the way to go. So taking the products of science and questioning them and pointing out that, for example, there's a conceptual confusion or that something hasn't been well defined or whatever, these are purely, in a sense, negative functions of philosophy that are valuable. And I'm a great believer in having people in universities whose main job is to, you know, be cultural critics or to be politically and socially critical. They wouldn't claim, you know, to have generated knowledge along the model of scientific knowledge. So, I suppose I just don't want to be tarred with a brush for a form of scientism which I won't defend. Of course, I think that.
Because you are willing, but you are willing to defend a form of scientism that basically says, that basically cracks a lot of jokes about the pursuit of wisdom and says that really what it's all about is knowledge. And that's part of my concern. I think we're in a world where the idea of trying to acquire wisdom is something suitable to be sneered at.
No, I
think that's
that
the achievement of scientism. You didn't say it, you implied.
No, I didn't imply. I explicitly said that sometimes what we do is we engage in a purely negative form of conceptual criticism, which undermines claims to knowledge and points out what isn't known. Now, that isn't to think that philosophy is only valuable because it produces knowledge at all. It's to say that philosophy can be valuable because it exposes intellectual hubris among scientists.
Yeah, I agree with that, but you did sneer at wisdom. Don't try and get out of it.
I said it was a laughter claim that philosophers are wiser than everybody else.
Which is not what I claim.
What isn't clear to me is why this should be a negative function of philosophy. So suppose someone has this project. Aristotle used a word which we translate rational. Economists talk about homo economicus as a rational being. And then we find the word rational used in other subject matters. A philosopher, given the sort of thing that they've been taught to do, is well placed to engage in inquiry whether the same concept of rationality is being used in different domains. Why is that negative?
All right, negative in the sense that it's not producing a new bit of knowledge, it's undermining someone else's...
But if we get the answer to the question, we know something we didn't know before.
Okay, so it's positive more broadly. Fine, I mean, don't put a lot on the word negative. All I'm saying is that even if it was very... Look, Socrates, sometimes he goes out, he has an inquiry, what is piety? At the end of the dialogue, you don't know what piety is. Okay? That, I think, that can be valuable. Okay? So all I'm saying is that even if it was a purely negative inquiry like that, it could still be valuable.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay, agreement. Let's take questions. So I did promise a couple of people who have been... This chap here was being very patient earlier. Then there's another question at the back on the edge. Oh, I'm probably being unfair on this side, aren't I? I'm facing this way. All right, I promise we'll come to you next. Sorry, yes.
Yes, hi. Is it possible that the humanities are pre-science and that we are precluded by the prevailing paradigm from a more powerful explanatory insight?
Okay. We'll come to that in a second, and then let's take that question.
So just, I guess the first question or the last question you were asking were the relationship between philosophical inquiry and scientific. And I think it would have been very enriching to have one or two scientists as well on the panel who would have been able to defend that position. But also just the main question of the title of the talk today, do science have all the answers? I would love to hear just their own perspectives, how they would define science, how they would define an answer. What is enough scientific evidence to say that it's socially acceptable, this scientific answer relative to another one? And then the final quick comment, if anyone has any insight on just scientific methods in general. Mathematics, statistics are always used. How much ideology is behind the scientific methods that are applied and the philosophical theories behind methods?
Those are all wonderful questions. I mean, pre-warn you, there's absolutely no way we're answering all of those. you need to come a couple of hours. Okay, so on our first question. Any thoughts?
Yeah, so on the first question, is humanity pre-science? Well, the answer is scientific thinkers think that it is, and people like me think that it isn't. And that's partly what I was trying to talk about earlier when I was saying I think one of the things I'm trying to do here is to defend the domain of what I called earlier the internal, what we're inside. When we are communicating with each other most of the time, when we're thinking, when we're interacting in a non-scientific way with bonobo chimpanzees and so on and so forth, what we're doing there is, in my view, fundamentally resistant to science.
Science, predominantly, I think we consider as quantitative, as it's a quantitative tool, and we can work from there. But maybe there's an alternative, qualitative tool there. That could be developed and that would provide alternative
values. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't actually agree with that. I think that science is in essence qualitative, and then the quantitative follows from that. But to connect this with the other question, what am I taking science to be? So I'm a Kuhnian. And what Kuhn believed, which is not what most people think Kuhn believed, because Kuhn is widely thought to be an anti-science thinker, which is a total travesty of his views. What Kuhn thought was that science had paradigms, that science was distinguished from other enterprises by means of generating this kind of detailed qualitative and then quantitative knowledge through the pursuit of a sustained pursuit of research questions within what he called a disciplinary matrix, a certain set of constraints. So my thought is that's something which is absolutely great. However, it's not everything. It's not even everything so far as knowledge is concerned, let alone so far as all the other things that I'm talking about are concerned.
Wonderful. Jen and James, do either of you want to make a scientific method or what demarcates science and what's distinctive about it, perhaps, if I can try and boil the question down? or any other aspect of the very complicated question at the back?
Well, one aspect of that question was, shouldn't we have some scientists on the panel? It's unclear to me that we should, actually. I mean, James has the advantage of knowing a great deal of science, probably more of what we could all agree with science than Rupert or I do. But if we're concerned in broad terms with the place of science in human life, I don't see why a scientist should be especially well placed to answer that question. Indeed, you might think a scientist would be rather prejudiced with respect to that question.
No, I agree with that. I mean, I think what often happens is scientists who get in the public speaking about philosophy have a very unscientific attitude to philosophy. That is, they sound off about it without having any empirical evidence about what philosophy is like. So they make generalisations and they don't admit that are true of some bits of philosophy, but not in general. And certainly not... Yeah, so I mean, not obvious to me that we qualify ourselves to be here by whether or not we happen to work in a philosophy department or a science faculty.
Okay, can I take a question on the end there? Can we get a... And is there another question on the side of the room as well? Okay, can we have the mic up there on the side of the room? Thanks.
I mean, I realise it's a bit late for this question, but you said, Rupert, that the human future is constitutively unknowable. And I think this is a very interesting question in terms of science as another form of prophecy that human beings have developed. We have literature, we have religion, but science is marked by the particularity of its predictive power. So it makes great claims for its ability to tell the future. And I think there is a huge issue around scientism in respect of, you know, scientific claims being made that are then invalidated. I'm thinking of the peaceful atom. You know, if you've read Alevich's book about Chernobyl, which has just won the Nobel Prize last year, it's a stunning indictment of a kind of scientist mindset. And I'd also raise the question of, you know, Leibniz said that space didn't exist. In modern physics, time doesn't exist because the equations can go either way. You know, there's not clear where the past is and where the future is. So, you know, you get someone like Lee Smolin writing a book saying, where is time? We've got to put time back in to our science, into our physics. His book is Time Reborn, which is a fantastic book. So I think there's a huge issue around time here, which we haven't really touched on. But, you know, as an area of inquiry, how far are we able to predict the future? You making an assertion, we can't do it. But then if time doesn't exist, or if all time exists simultaneously...
These are very, very big philosophical questions. Any other topic? Can we get the next question? Because we're running out of time, and we'll try and say... Just pass this down. Thank you.
My question's been slightly overtaken by events, but I think it's still worth asking it. Why do you think that a panel of four philosophers and no scientists is best placed to judge this? Shouldn't you have had a fair balance?
I will. I mean, I'm going to say one thing about that last comment, which is, I mean, James and I are not scientists, but we are. I mean, philosophers. I do have quite a lot of physics degree and various other such things. It's not a completely science-free panel, but there was an answer given to that question just now. So I think I'm going to bracket that. We're going to quickly ask if we can get very brief answers to the question of. I think I'm going to try and... Lee Smolin's philosophy of time, I think I'm going to leave on one side. I can have lots of comments on that. But perhaps this question that science... I want to put aside the idea that scientism is saying this, because I'm sure there are people who say this. Do you think that science really claims to be able to predict the future, and is this some terrible hubris?
Well, so I think this is directed towards me. So I think that... all I would say, like a conditional, right? If science does try to do that, then so much the worse for science, or rather, it's being scientistic. Now, that sounds a very strange thing to say in a way, because so much of science is about prediction and control. What I'm saying is, yes, and so here we have a reason why it is not possible to export the scientific method to the human world. It doesn't make sense for the reason that I gave. It's constitutively impossible to predict the future because, for example, any prediction of the future, a change of the future, can be deliberately undermined or realised by human beings responding to it. This is not true of atoms and genes and planets and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, we don't have more time for the rest of your wonderful question. Just one word on the other question. I would turn the question around. There are so many panels and science festivals and so on and so forth where scientists sit together on a panel and wax lyrical about all sorts of things with nary a philosopher in sight.
Lee Smolin wrote a book about time.
The science festival later this year, they have philosophers as well.
Yeah, I know they do sometimes.
We have run out of time, but I'm going to allow sort of because 30 seconds on any of the last topics.
I thought that
Jennifer
your
James.
Question was, does science claim to predict the future? I take it that locally it does. I mean, a scientist who's done experiments and determined that such and such is the case takes the experiments to be replicable. So if they were to set the initial conditions in place again, then they could predict what would happen. And that's right, often enough. But I think when Rupert spoke of science not predicting the future, he wasn't actually interested in whether science has predictive power within its domain.
Yeah, no, sure.
It was about the future of humanity. Mm. And like Rupert, I think scientists have very little to say about how humanity might develop. I think geopolitical people might have something to say.
James, any last?
There are loads of things about the natural world that aren't predictable. Human beings are part of the natural world, and lots about us isn't exactly predictable. On the other hand, large-scale behaviour of people in groups is quite predictable as well. We all know how to predict. You know, we all are familiar with empirical evidence teaching us the way a certain situation is going to go and saying in advance, yeah, you could see that they were going to get themselves into that situation and predict what mistakes they were going to make, and then they make them. So the idea that human beings aren't predictable, I think, is a bit overblown. I mean, lots of people's behaviour is all too predictable.
Sometimes they can't. I can't help thinking of the experiment at Holborn Tube Station. Do you know about this? So they determined in their wisdom that people would leave the tube when lots were getting off if you had to stand on both sides of the escalator. And they made a prediction about how many more people per minute one would get out of the tube station. And actually, their prediction was exceeded. But what they said they couldn't predict is how resistant people might be to not running up the tube, which a lot of people are disposed to do, even at Holborn, where it's very steep and long. So actually, they precisely had to do this experiment because they didn't know how human beings would behave in such circumstances. And I think it's, you know, culturally very local.
And on that note, I'm afraid we're going to have to end tonight's proceedings. Thank you very much to the audience and to our panel.